Welcome back to the Island of Snack podcast to a, let's say, stellar episode this time. I'm your host, Fabian Ahlefeld, and today we're venturing into the final frontier with a space roundtable featuring an all-star panel. And it's been almost a year since we talked about space on this podcast. We had Paul Gradle on the show some time ago. And Paul and I'll introduce him in a second again, we came up with this idea of a space roundtable. So here we are. And joining us today are, of course, Paul Gradle. He's a principal engineer at NASA. Ileana Fu, industry manager for aerospace and medical at Trumpf and X-Relativity Space and SpaceX. We have Advanit Makaya. He's an advanced manufacturing engineer at the European Space Agency. And last but not least, Miles Keeper. He's the additive manufacturing manager at Rocket Lab. And it is great timing for such an episode. Yesterday, SpaceX was able to reach orbital velocity with its latest Starship launch. It also provided us with really beautiful imagery of its reentry. Rocket Lab also just had its 45th launch a few days ago, I think March 12th, my birthday, with 22 additional launches planned for this year. And last month, the first metal 3D printer was installed on the ISS. So it's a great time to have this panel. Space and additive manufacturing are accelerating rapidly. And therefore, without further ado, let's get started. Paul, Ileana, Advanit, and Miles, welcome to Additive Snack.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, let's dive right into the core of this interface of space and additive manufacturing. And we'll start a bit high level and then make our way deeper and deeper into the core of the technology. But Miles, since you're at Rocket Lab and you have such a good overview of the state of the industry, could you help us understand a little bit more, what is the current state of additive manufacturing in space and how critical is it actually for human space exploration in the industry?
Yeah, I can take a stab at that for sure. I think probably a couple of us in here who have maybe a bit of a different perspective on this as well. But I think that additive manufacturing is a very critical application in the space industry, you know, especially if we're considering technologies like laser powder bed fusion, various forms of DED, and then even some polymer printing. You know, there's people printing patterns for investment castings and things like that. And I think that's also really important and often overlooked. It opens a lot of doors. It allows us to kind of fail fast, you know, so we can iterate really quickly with technologies like powder bed fusion or DED, where we can, you know, we don't have to spend years going through analysis and making sure that we have a design finalized before we actually jump into making parts. You know, there's oftentimes that we can build up, you know, various different flavors of the same part before going into a testing campaign and have all those ready. And that's really good. It's the barrier of entry into getting parts made is a little bit lower. There's like really big benefits in everything from part consolidation to geometric freedom that you can get with some of these technologies. So, you know, if we're thinking about laser powder bed fusion, for instance, you know, this opens up a whole bunch of possibilities for things like region channels and mass optimization that you just don't have with other technologies. Yeah. And then just, you know, shrinking that length of the supply chain, which is kind of related to this like rapid iteration thing as well. You know, we don't have to, you know, a part that maybe used to go through 100 different pieces that were installed into one parent part that had to go through all these different types of post processes can now be kind of boiled down into monolithic parts. You know, it's like each process that you take out of that manufacturing value stream is just another process that you don't have to worry about something going wrong in. So making that a lot shorter is very helpful. And then the whole material side, and I think we'll probably get into that a little bit later, but, you know, if we're looking at laser powder bed fusion again, in particular, the material space opens up so much. You could do things that just weren't possible with other manufacturing methods in the past. So yeah, I think it plays an absolutely critical role, especially for these new space companies that are coming up who need to get products to market quickly and test quickly. Rocket development's extremely expensive, so shortening that time span is really important in order for people to have a shot at surviving.
Yeah, it's interesting. Usually, you know, if we engage with industries, they oftentimes either look at the performance aspect of additive manufacturing, which is valuable to an organization. So complex designs, et cetera, or they look at the supply chain aspects as mainly for spare parts. But I think one of the reasons why additive is so critical to the space industry is because both aspects are so critical to its success. Ileana, you've experienced the space industry from various different angles, from SpaceX to also now being at Trump at a machine manufacturer. So you've seen all aspects and facets of it. From your perspective, what are really today the top five applications that are additively manufactured for space missions today?
Yeah, it's a really interesting statement and totally agree with everything that Miles just listed for the advantages of using AM as a tool. I think if you're talking about laser-based processes, obviously laser powder bed fusion and laser DED are very interesting techniques, but there's also laser DED with wire that's becoming even more interesting. And we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about that because I don't think we have too many good examples of that. And just want to say there is also the WAM process, the wire arc additive, and also electron beam that we don't spend a lot of time talking about because everyone really talks about laser powder bed fusion as probably the most, you know, numerous examples of applications today. And they can be anything from small satellite thrusters to antenna to actual engine parts. You know, you have your injector and your nozzle parts as well. Small structures or large structures, anything that will fit inside a powder bed machine, are things that people have investigated. So all of those things are, you know, of interest. What we're seeing now, though, are even larger structures that don't fit inside a powder bed machine, like the very, very large nozzle skirt. So that's where things like DED and freeform additive manufacturing is coming more into play. So you start seeing more of those examples as we go on. But yes, it's a great tool, but it's not the only tool. And sometimes we just need to be aware that it isn't the right answer for that particular application. Or sometimes the thing that you want to print isn't even available in that raw material. So just something to think about.
That's a good point. And I think we should definitely touch on those limitations maybe as we go further into depth throughout this discussion, especially as we scale up and we're planning more and more launches like Rocket Lab is. Maybe, Paul, from your perspective, anything to add on these statements?
I think it's a great point that don't use additive unless you have to. And I think one thing that has been challenging is training some of the new engineers that were brought up in this digital world. Right. And always having access to a 3D printer, they didn't necessarily struggle through making a combustion chamber the old way with plating and brazing and, you know, failing chambers through the manufacturing process and high scrap rates. So I do think there's a bit of education that we need to do there and just say that not everything fits into this additive, you know, box per se, that there's a lot of traditional manufacturing out there that hasn't gone away. There's still a lot of advancements there. And I do think that, you know, at times you're not necessarily going to get the cost advantage if you're trading it improperly, because you can do a lot of great things with machining. But additive is a good supplement to that. You know, I can't think of any engine or application out there where you're not going to use a mix of traditional manufacturing and additive manufacturing. And like Miles and Eliana said, you know, taking advantage of the complexity of additive, part consolidation, new materials that we couldn't make with previous methods, you know, or really difficult to manufacturing methods. You know, again, going back to that traditional manufacturing perspective, you know, if you haven't gotten yelled at your machinist by bringing a piece of Inconel to them and them telling you how difficult it's going to be to do that, you know, maybe need to learn that lesson before you venture into additive. But I think, you know, one of the big things aside from that too is maybe you don't use additive manufacturing in your production. Maybe you use it just during your prototyping, like Miles said, during that design fail fix cycle. And I can iterate very quickly on that. And then when I'm doing high volume production, maybe I switch over to a more traditional process. So again, we can use the tools in front of us to speed that up, because traditionally, when we've been doing rocket engine development, you know, it can be 5 to 7 years for some of these very large engines. And sometimes you're waiting on parts or forgings, maybe 6 months or a year. Parts might be a couple of years on that. And that's just time that you're sitting waiting on that. So there's a huge opportunity, like Eliana and Miles stated, for using additive in different parts of the life cycle.
Interesting. We always talk about how do we educate engineers about additive manufacturing. Now you're bringing how do we unteach additive manufacturing to the next generation. That's okay. That's an interesting perspective. I never thought about that, but it's true. Yeah. How about you, Anvinit? From a European Space Agency perspective, what does the adoption of additive look like in the European region and its players?
So I think additive, as in the US or other part of the world, is slowly going away from the hype phase where it was cool, it was nice to try things, and we promised a little bit too much. And there's a lot of maturity now being gained, as Paul explained. You fail, you figure out how hard it is, and then you start to understand where it really helps and where it's just superfluous. So that's what we're seeing in Europe. We are moving away slowly towards more primary structures, more critical parts, as opposed to brackets and things like that, where you get some benefits from lightweighting, etc., but where it's not really critical. So I would say as the maturity is increasing, the challenges are understood, we are evolving towards, I would say, more core parts of the developments. So I think it's a great time to be in additive, because we are really trying to pinpoint where it can add value as opposed to doing additive for doing additive.
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm glad that it is moving out of the hype curve, right? I think it benefits everyone, from OEMs to users to contract manufacturers, to really have realistic expectations on the other end. And also what comes with the hype cycle is really that we're kind of moving into what you said, maturity of the technology. And I think here materials play a huge role, right? If you look at the history of at least metal additive manufacturing, except for the early days where we really just mixed in bronze with steel to be able to melt that material, we then really moved into how do we copy conventional manufacturing materials in the additive space to accelerate adoption. We're now entering a space where new materials are being unlocked by additive manufacturing. You know, materials that are crucial for AM expansion, GRCOP42 is a great example. Liana, you mentioned it even in our previous conversations. So I'm curious to hear, maybe starting with you, Paul, you know, what materials are currently key to space applications, but also where do we see some gaps that we can fill with innovative materials and alloys that can really also accelerate space?
Yeah, so I think materials is probably one of the areas that I'm most excited about in additive. For decades, we've been using materials that have worked, but we've always wanted performance improvements. We wanted materials at higher temperatures, higher strength, some of these unique environments in hydrogen and oxygen, high pressure, high temperature. And I think the early days of additive, right, you had two or three materials. It's like you needed to make titanium or aluminum silicon 10 meg or, you know, stainless 316 work in your application. Now we've really expanded that materials database, but we're still very much aligned with some of the traditional materials, right? We've developed all the Inconels and the Haynes. There's a lot of advancements in aluminum, but still have some lineage to traditional manufacturing. I think in the last couple of years, we've really seen this onset of, you know, everybody opened their eyes saying, wow, we can make materials that we could never make before with additive. GRCOP alloys, the copper chrome niobium, are one example. I wouldn't say the best example, but we can make them traditionally, but they were very difficult. It was very long lead for those materials. They started out as a powder form, and then we'd have to HIP consolidate them or, you know, convert them to a forging eventually. well, since I have that powder, I can go direct in the additive process. So it's almost like it was made for additive manufacturing. It prints really well. Then that opened us up to, you know, these different types of materials we can do, even different classes of materials. So NASA has been involved in developing NASA HR1, which is a hydrogen-resistant iron-nickel-based material, which, again, was very difficult to make traditionally. An additive, it's been a breeze. It builds beautifully. We've advanced new classes of materials. For instance, the GRX 810, which is an ODS, oxide dispersion strength material, which you really couldn't make with traditional methods. And again, with additive, it's very simple to go advance these materials. I think it's not just about the availability of the materials, but the ability to iterate on these as well. So with traditional material development and material science, we'd have to go through and cast it and forge it. And, you know, it'd be 6 months or a year before we would get some initial samples. Now we can go through iterations using, you know, some of the thermal calculation softwares and run 2,000 to 5,000 iterations to figure out, like, is this even going to be weldable before we get into a machine? And what phases am I forming? Is this the elements in there, they're going to play together nicely? So we can do that. And then we can get powder pretty quickly, and we can be in the machine in a matter of weeks or months. And then you can go through those iterations. So it's sped up the materials engineering process side of this too. And I would imagine in 10 years, 20 years, that we're probably not using the same materials and additive that we are today. You know, there's a few of them that will probably remain, but I expect a lot of new materials to mature over time, and we're just going to see the advantages of that and adopt those long term.
Yeah, Fabian, I got a couple more examples to go alongside GR-COP. A perfect one is C-103, which traditionally has been extremely expensive to source in North America. Very difficult. Only one mill produced that from a VAR ESR melting process to then rolling that to sheet, which is very limited because they only had one mill that's only 25 inches wide. And then you'd have to water jet cut those. And then there would be a lot of dangers associated with very, very sharp edges. So then materials handling became an issue. And then not only that, but TIG or EB welding, and then doing some SimSide coating. So if you could take that material, erase that whole manufacturing process and just print that. Obviously, you have to get the powder first, but you would decrease a lot of not just, you know, lead time, but also, you know, personnel materials handling risks that material also, you know, that contributed to a huge part of that cost. And now you say, AM, hey, what a great tool. We can just, you know, go to, but there's very small printed parts or even larger parts. So that's a great example where AM is also changing the way we manufacture the parts from the raw material side. Another one would be high strength aluminium, what we consider high strength for aluminium as opposed to something like steel or titanium for example. But think about the 6061 variants that have now very affordable strengthening mechanisms. So something like a 6061 RAM 2, where as opposed to those other traditional materials where the strengthening mechanism is a rare earth that's in a very sort of like only comes from one mine in a region which could be potentially a conflict region. Why not reduce that risk in the supply chain and also decrease the cost? So there are a multitude more materials I could go on. Let's say gamma titanium aluminides, which in the titanium industry we've been trying to make for about 40 years and haven't been able to successfully do it other than PAM. Now you can 3D print those. So those are all examples of where the 3D printing process has removed all those manufacturing steps in the traditional world and also those other, you know, sort of risks and things that come along with that.
Yeah, very interesting. And without trying to derail this conversation too far, but just a few months ago, I read an article about DeepMind, which launched a project to really use AI to investigate different material combinations and alloys that have never been tried before. And to Paul's point, using additive for fast iterations and validating some of these materials seems to be very interesting to me. Does anybody have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that Paul and Orlando kind of just hit the nail right on the head with all that, honestly. I think the big thing that was touched on was like the different strengthening mechanisms that are available when using additive. So Paul talked about GRX810, great example of an oxide dispersion strengthened alloy. There's other people doing, printing alloys that in the rock form have a much different microstructure because of the different manufacturing process that the rock material is made with. But when they print it, because of that rapid cooling, they're seeing, carbide dispersion strengthening through the parts too. So, depending on the material, you could add things to it that are actually favorable for the manufacturing process, that rapid melting and solidification. And yeah, these strengthening mechanisms are kind of only possible with the additive process. I think there's a lot of traditional materials that people are comfortable with, but a lot of those materials have, their chemistry is kind of tailored for the way that the rock material is manufactured. And that's not always favorable for the additive manufacturing process. So I think kind of like what Paul was talking about, in like the next 10 years or so, there's going to be a whole different class of alloys that people are using for more, specific applications. And yeah, the alloy development space is just, it's super exciting, right? Because like you're not really bound to these past fillers that you'd have to put in chemistry for the manufacturing processes. You could tailor the chemistry for the additive manufacturing process and make an alloy that's much more, you can print at higher throughput rates. You can get further away from needing a bunch of post-processing after printing. So you could reduce the amount of, heat treating that's required compared to traditional alloys and things like that. So I think, as the additive technology starts to mature, the next frontier is the material side that kind of favors the technology.
Yeah.
And I would say the revolution in the material side is very much happening. You talked about DeepMind and Paul talked about using computational tools. There's a growing field called ICME, Integrated Computational Materials Engineering, which is about developing modeling tools to understand what's happening to the microstructure at different level, from atomic to component level, so multiphysics, etc. That's being applied more and more to understand the processes and also to understand new materials. Artificial intelligence is coming right on point to add machine learning capabilities to these ICME tools. And we are also seeing new materials like high entropy alloys, for example, who can expand the strength and the ductility of metallic materials at the same time. Metallic glasses have been around for a while. So all this convergence of improving the capabilities of computational tools and also new chemical recipes for metallic materials are right on point for being harnessed by additive manufacturing.
Interesting.
I'd add the one challenge I've seen with this, though, is we develop these new materials and then the bar keeps getting set higher. You say, hey, we can go develop this material and we can run it at 1100 C for 5,000 hours. And then a customer comes in and says, that's great. I want 10,000 hours. So, trying to manage some of the expectations of the materials development is a bit challenging, too, because you have this wide open space. It's like you can do anything you want on this, but there's still definitely limitations that we need to consider. I think one of the things that is exciting about material development but challenging is now we have a new material, right? We need to go characterize that material and make sure that it's safe for human space flight and other applications.
Yeah. What does that mean for you guys, Miles, as a manufacturer? All of these materials that promise interesting applications, how do you build that into your roadmap? Are there certain applications that you see being enabled by these specific alloys?
Yeah, I think the way we treat it is, we'll start with something, like a traditional alloy that has a lot of kind of like heresy. There's a lot of information that exists about a material. So we'll start with something that we know and that there's a bunch of data on. But, you know, if we think about like the Archimedes engine, right, the Archimedes engine that we're building right now to power our next rocket, Neutron, it's an Oxrich stage combustion cycle, very challenging environment, high pressure, high temperature oxygen, really likes to turn a lot of robust metals into glorified firewood. Like it'll just burn in that environment. So, you know, it's like we're starting with a material that we know works in that environment, but we're actively, you know, working on developing alloys in the background that are just better suited for that environment and better suited for the printing process in particular. So, yeah, that's kind of the way we handle it. Go with a known thing up front to buy down a little bit of risk. And then in the background, start collecting as much data as possible until you're comfortable with kind of switching over to a new novel alloy. Because like Paul said, like characterizing an alloy is much more than, you know, running some tensile tests and saying, oh, look, I got great tensile properties. Like let's go throw that into this multi-million dollar machine and hope for the best. It's you know, there's a lot of work that goes into the characterization. So yeah, it's kind of the way we approach it. Start with something known and develop in the background in parallel.
Okay, interesting. From a European Space Agency perspective, what are current application development projects that you can talk about that, you know, leverage additive manufacturing for new, possibly today unseen applications?
So, yeah, as I say, moving from secondary structures to more primary structures, some of our rockets, for example, Ariane 5 already had the primary structures in it. But on the satellite side, we are looking at core structural parts of the satellites. We are doing a lot as well in functional materials, for example, RF applications, where additive is really responding to the challenges in terms of complexity of internal channels, etc. So at the same time, broadening the range of applications and also moving towards critical parts. And there is also an area which is very much emerging, which we are looking at more and more, is manufacturing in space. So moving from manufacturing something on Earth, sticking it as much as we can within a fairing, and then launching it, to manufacturing directly in space. So this has different advantages. You are not limited by the size of the fairing, so you can make very large antenna to increase the data throughput, very large solar arrays to increase the power per launch, basically the power that your payload is accessing. And also you can build lighter structures because they don't have to go through the launch phase. Other applications in exploration, making on-demand manufacturing of hardware to limit the logistics, the resupply logistics. So we are developing the technological building blocks to make that happen, and that can be illustrated by the first metal printer, which we launched a few weeks ago, which is being commissioned at the moment. So yes, manufacturing in space is a bit of a dream at the moment, but if you are slowly establishing the building blocks, maturing them, slowly it will become a reality. Just as additive 40 years ago was a bit of a dream, and now it's flying in a number of spacecraft.
Yeah, I could even imagine that a space environment is very interesting for material properties. You know, you have zero oxygen out there if you were produced outside of the space station. Is that also something that is being investigated up there?
Absolutely. You saw the first flight of Varda Space, which is a U.S. company who's developing space factories, basically. So there is a growing interest in commercial ventures which would manufacture things at a level of quality that you cannot achieve on Earth, and then sell them at a high premium back to us. So that's also an area that's very much in progress.
Very interesting. How about from your perspective, Paul? What are some innovative applications that you guys are working on at the moment?
I think we're still heavily focused on launch vehicles and propulsion systems. Is we've been doing it for, you know, 12 years or greater on that, but the industry is still trying to sort of wrap their heads around, well, how do we do this repeatedly? How do we do it safely? What are the standards and, you know, the expectations of what these parts need to meet? And NASA has been central on developing some of the specifications, the standard, the NASA 6030 and 6033 are additive manufacturing for human spaceflight. And we talk a lot about in there the process control, which is like foundational control, and the part production control on that. And that's probably the most common question that we get, you know, moving forward is like, well, what do I need to follow as part of this? And like Miles was alluding to, that you have to know your process really well, right? I need to know my my parameter box, but I also need to know like what happens when I have off nominal parameters in that, when I start to change my laser power or my scan speed a little bit, when does the material go bad? And, you know, that is a huge challenge because there's so many different parameters, all the different feedstocks, the inputs, the process on that. So where am I really sensitive on that? And I think that's one thing that will help us push forward, is for the industry to get a better understanding of the process itself. You know, and then once I do some of that initial sensitivity studies, then I go into the heat treatment aspect of this, is I need to understand how the material is going to respond to these different heat treatments. Do I need to do HIP? Am I not doing HIP? You know, stress relief, solution aging, that every material has a different process that I'm going through. And I think there's sort of a lack of understanding in a sense on this as well. And with additive, it gets even more complex because I have different sections on the part where one might be thicker and one might be thinner. And I have a different microstructure that might respond differently during heat treatment. So, you know, one thing that I often say is that a lot of us that weren't metallurgists by trade have had to learn that aspect of it. And I have, you know, a lot more respect now for Eliana and folks that were trained, you know, in material science, because we all appreciate that now. And we understand, you know, the material science pyramid and what you've been trying to tell us for years about, you know, my process is going to control my microstructure, which is going to control my properties. So I think there's still a lot of education and understanding around that to move forward, you know, and we still see some resistance to additive, right? Where we have been making parts for many decades with the traditional process, and we're saying, hey, now I can go make this part a lot faster and I can do it a lot cheaper, but there's hesitancy there, right? It's like, well, I need to do the cost trade and the risk associated with implementing a new part that may not perform the same on that. So some of those barriers to adoption. But I think we're starting to look at new applications, tanks, even like some of the cryogenic fluid management, where we need to put some of these tanks in orbit and you need to keep your fuel cold for a really long time without boil off. And there's new applications of additive that we can see in that, where I'm using a series of regen channels, you know, to make these very complex, large structures. Like Edvinit had mentioned, in-space manufacturing is a significant area of growth, particularly for NASA. We want to be building parts, you know, not only on orbit, but when we return to the moon and go to Mars. We're looking at, you know, how do we go build parts and launch pads and power plants and the infrastructure to sustain presence on the moon. So now we're using the in-situ resources, the lunar dust, you know, to go create parts from, you know, and extract different elements from that to make in-situ additive manufacturing work. And obviously we don't know what we don't know yet. We're trying to do the early experiments on that, but, you know, really excited about the potential of that. And then that of course brings a question too. It's like, okay, now I'm building parts in space. Well, how do I make sure that those parts are safe, and how do I qualify those parts in space? So I think a lot of it comes back to some of that foundational control. You know, what are my requirements? What do I need to meet? And one thing that we always like to say about the NASA specifications is, you know, they're tailorable. They're there as a guideline. You don't have to follow every single step on this if you're not required contractually to adhere to it. So use it as a guideline and adjust it. But I think, again, having that basic understanding of the process, you know, who's responsible for what, how am I going to approve, you know, that, who is the approving organization? Like, that's a lot of the questions that we need to be asking on it. And I think one thing that we've seen with the shift from additive is we've always done a lot of this qualification with traditional manufacturing, but now everybody wants to go really fast with additive. So they expect the qualification process to go really fast as well. So I think education, again, in that area is important.
Yeah, very interesting points. And, you know, you mentioned space is accelerating. I mean, like I mentioned in the beginning, correct me if I'm wrong, Miles, but yeah, just you guys launched 45 missions so far, but have 22 scheduled for this year. So it's a very rapid growth curve that also requires manufacturing to accelerate quite quickly. So Ileana, maybe asking you that question, you, like we mentioned, have experience from Relativity to SpaceX, and now you are at a very established machine manufacturer, Triumph, that really understands the whole manufacturing process chain, not just additive. How do you see additive keeping up with that acceleration of manufacturing? And do you see some gaps or opportunities there?
If you're talking about in terms of learning from all the other industries and manufacturing processes that are currently going on, I think it's like a loop. So yes, absolutely, you can learn from it. And this also ties into what Paul was saying before about what a future needs in space will be. So for example, you mentioned if we go to explore more planetary bodies like the moon and other Mars and future maybe asteroids and so on, you can imagine a world where people are going to need structures to live in. They're going to need mobile labs. How do you construct those? How do you make those? You can actually take learnings from what we're doing on Earth now. So in a completely unrelated industry, which you may not pay attention to, people are 3D printing houses. Okay, they're printing concrete, so it's not quite the same material, but you could extend that, or you could imagine you could extend that to lunar regolith. Has anyone done that? Maybe they have, and they're not sharing the results. But that's part of where that learning comes from. The same thing with, we saw a 3D printed bridge in Amsterdam. So you know that the bridge has got to be safe enough for people to walk on and carry their load. And maybe a van drives across it a couple of times a day or something like that. So all of those learnings, those learning opportunities of what we're doing on Earth in what you would think are completely unrelated applications, they could be transferable when you have the key points or the critical maybe failure mechanisms, or maybe that bridge is going to break one day, or, you know, maybe a 3D printed house, you know, develops some cracking issues or some moisture or humidity issues. Those are learnings that you can take with you as you do your space exploration. So I think that, you know, even though they're not things that we're directly working on, we should all be keeping, you know, an awareness of that. And, you know, remarking that as a point in the sand, someone's 3D printed a house, someone's 3D printed a bridge. These are huge structures, but they are structures that humans, as a human race, that we need. We're going to need somewhere to live. We're going to need somewhere to, you know, traverse canyons and things like that in the future. I don't know what they look like, or maybe they're frozen rivers on Mars or something like that that we haven't discovered yet. But all those things, you know, you have to keep an open mind with that. Now, I know you're laughing, but it's not quite science fiction. It's science fiction of today, but it will be science fact 20 years from now or 10 years from now. You know, when people said, oh, you know, I was watching, so I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and I happened to watch an episode of Picard. Okay, it's not really a great show, but they were 3D printing something. I was like, what are they 3D printing in Star Trek now? Actually, that's the wrong technology, because when you use the replicator is based on transporter technology. But anyway, I'm not going to nitpick that. The point is, it's in 3D printing or additive is in the consciousness. People know what it is. Even lay people, they're not scared of it. You know, when I go to the mall and I wear my Adidas shoes, they, oh, 3D printed shoes. They've heard something about it. They've seen now 3D printed basketball, you know, that has, you don't need to pump it. So all these things that you think are in completely unrelated, they're all little steps that help us to get to where we're going.
Yeah, really good points. We're maybe further than we think we are. Right? We're quite critical, us being in the additive manufacturing space of ourselves, but maybe we underestimate the advancements that we've done in the past 10 to 20 years. Yeah, really good points. Miles, from a manufacturer's perspective, like I mentioned, 22 launches scheduled this year. How many launches after that and after that? What does that growth curve look like, and how are you keeping up with that manufacturing demand?
Yeah, so yeah, this year is 22 planned. Not really at liberty about talking about future kind of outlook and stuff. That's one of my only rules is of talking as a publicly traded company. But yeah, the scalability of additive is really fantastic, right? Because it's like we're always targeting max utilization rates on machines. You know, we're buying expensive machines. Nearly half the price of a part comes from the machine depreciation that's being cooked into that part that you're printing. So we're always targeting, you know, 85% plus kind of utilization rates on our machines, just to, so that we're being as economic as possible with them. But the good thing is that makes us very strategic about what parts go on what machines and how many we could get from an output perspective on each machine. So scaling becomes pretty easy at that point. You know, if you have a facility that's ready and has space for a machine and has everything, you know, enough air, enough argon, enough HVAC capacity and all that, it's a matter of, you know, some capital and, you know, adding another machine in as you need to scale. So yeah, so that's a big thing for us. I think, you know, we're producing a lot this year. You know, you mentioned 22 launches. That means that, you know, at minimum, we need to build 220 engines for the Rutherford or for Electron. So we need to build 220 Rutherford engines minimum. So yeah, realistically, it's probably going to be like closer to, you know, 230, 250. So keeping that humming along in the background while balancing all the Archimedes development is a real fun thing. But now we're at the same point of Archimedes where, you know, we're maximizing all the machines utilizations there and trying to figure out, you know, what parts are actually being printed long term versus parts that we're iterating on now that might get casting later on. How do we balance that? How do we, you know, we're learning at which knobs we need to turn once that scaling opportunity comes. So yeah, that's kind of how we handle that. We kind of take a step back and really look at it holistically. And it's always about the maximization of utilization. The machines are expensive, so you don't want them just sitting there and having a bunch of machines for the sake of having a bunch of machines. It's all about running efficiently. And yeah.
No, thanks for sharing that. That's very helpful to understand where the industry is going and how you guys are preparing for growth.
Yeah, so just keeping a pulse on the industry, right? Because I think, you know, Paul talks about materials, how, oh, I have this material that can operate at, you know, 1,000 degrees Celsius, and someone says, oh, I want it 10,000, or, you know, it's like people always want more. And I think the same could be said about machines. You know, people always want bigger, faster, stronger, cheaper. It's like all of these things, right? So it's the users that are kind of continuously feeding demand into the machine manufacturers and giving them that feedback. So trying to keep a pulse on, you know, what the future looks like from machine manufacturers as well, and kind of in the background planning that for future iterations of products, saying, okay, well, instead of printing, you know, four of these parts and welding them together, now I can consider, you know, having a larger monolithic print for this and kind of trying to bake that in to your plans as you scale as well. So it's an ever evolving industry. So you can't just go take a look at, you know, where the industry is today and say, okay, I'm going to make all my plans based on the current state of the industry. It's, you have to really keep your finger on the pulse.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also the concept of, well, that person has a machine that's this big, so I need to build my 10 more centimeters bigger. No, I'm going to make mine 10 more centimeters. No, I'm going to make mine. And then it's like an arms race. They just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then put more lasers into it. And actually, by the time that you've made the biggest machine, it's like as big as a house. Why did you do that? You could have just done that by DED. So sometimes that's not the answer. It's like a race to incrementally increase something, whereas this other technology over here could have actually done the job better, cheaper, but people didn't know about it. So there's some of that as well. You know, I think as machine manufacturers, you don't want to necessarily get dragged into a race. Oh, well, let me get like 10 steps in front of you. No, I'm going to get more. No, I'm going to get more. Like, when you could have done something else over here, let's say laser with wire on a freeform basis or something like that. And so those are kind of considerations which exactly speak to your point. You know, I'm a designer. I have a part. I need to print it, you know, 1.2 meters in the Z height. Oh, but then someone else, well, you know, if we just did a little bit more, the 1.5, and then it starts becoming, you know, uncontrollable. And so I think there also should be some degree of responsibility of, hey, which direction are we going? And maybe as a community, it's better to have that conversation together rather than in a competitive environment where you're not really doing the best for the user, the end user. They're the people who are really going to be at your mercy, at your will, if you like. And just because you can put hundreds of lasers on a machine doesn't mean you should. So there's some degree of responsibility machine manufacturers need to take in terms of equipment, which is why, let's say, if you're a manufacturer that has multiple different techniques, those are different things that you can offer people. Don't just offer something with an IR laser. You can offer a green or a blue laser, a laser in the visible wavelength of light. So it's all different. And I think having that kind of diversity is actually quite helpful.
No, I totally agree. I think from a machine manufacturer's point of view, right, I think we're pretty much aligned here, right? More lasers isn't always the answer. And if you run the analysis down to cost per part, the benefits actually diminishes once you reach, I think, really 6+. I do think that customization and modularity in additive manufacturing are going to become more and more important to meet the demands of the different users of the technology.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Eliana, on the machines. Like, we've been tracking it over the last 10 years. And, you know, for a while we were asking ourselves, like, well, why are all these engines at 25,000 pounds of thrust? It's like, because everybody was building in the 250 by 250 millimeter platform. And then we see all these larger engines coming out that are built for, you know, the 600 millimeter platform or the 400 millimeter platform. So we're sort of seeing some of the limitations in the rocket technology based on the machine. But I do think that a lot of that has been driven by powder bed fusion, and the industry is starting to adopt a lot more of DED and other techniques, you know, even some of the solid state techniques, cold spray and additive friction stir deposition, not just for building, you know, these near net shaped parts, but building forgings and casting replacements, which allows us to go faster and cheaper as well. One thing that I don't want to lose sight of is we've talked a bit about the machine limitations, but, you know, I think what we've seen is really a critical area is the post-processing side of this. I can go build 100 parts on machines, but I still have to depowder the parts. I have to remove them from the build plate. I have to do heat treatments on them. And we've seen, you know, that is the bottleneck sometimes, right? The EDM machine gets backed up trying to get parts off the build plate, or I don't have a hip furnace that is big enough to do some of these parts that we're starting to produce now. And I think we have to really focus on that whole end-to-end life cycle too, when we talk about additive, not just the build process, but all those decisions that we make in post-processing go into that initial design. How am I going to hold this part when I'm doing machining on it? How am I going to inspect this part? And I think there's a lot of areas that those supplemental technologies definitely need to catch up to the build process itself and the understanding of how I properly design for additive, right? The DFAM is not just the build process. It's that whole end to end. And I think there's, you know, potentially even new inspection technologies or new ways that we're going to approach this that haven't even been developed yet that need to catch up with the additive build process.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think another thing about that is, like, it's not always just about DFAM. It's about DFM in general, right? Like, talk to your downstream owners, people who are running the EDMs, people who are running the CNC machines. Like, there's oftentimes, you know, you work with a design team, you go, okay, here's the part, but there's also an importance of, you also have the ability to print in features that can help with the downstream processes that are just there to do that as well. And to your point, from a different perspective, it's like, we talk a lot about machines, but I think we're at a point in the industry too, where, like, the hardware is kind of far surpassed the software. You know, it's like, you have these very capable pieces of hardware that are, you know, state of the art, but you have to go through this kind of fragmented stream of taking your digital part through a bunch of different tools, depending on what material you're using for, you know, thermal simulations and things that you're going to do based off those thermal simulations, and then back into a different software for support generation. There's a lot of areas that become a little bit painful that are not just machine related, facilities even, right? So it's like, facilities is the machine that feeds the machine. It's not like CNC machining where it's like, oh, the air went out, no big deal, we'll get it back up and running. It's like, no, your air and your argon and your HVAC and your water chilling, it needs to be working for, like, weeks on end sometimes without a blip. And I think that's maybe often overlooked as well.
Yeah, really what it comes down to is building that ecosystem around the additive manufacturing process. And I think, Ileana, you mentioned it, for these ecosystem partners to work together, to partner, and to together lift the capabilities of the whole industry. And I think, especially in the US, we see a lot of private companies also pushing into the space industry and trying to support it and add different services to it. What does that look like in Europe? I know there's also a very big growth trend from private companies that are pushing into space. I mean, just in my hometown, where I was at least born and raised in Munich, ESA Aerospace is one of those players. What does that ecosystem look like in Europe?
Well, I think it's fair to say a lot of the key additive machine manufacturers came from Europe, Arkham, EOS, to name only a few. So I would say the wave kind of started here. And then for various reasons, the momentum has shifted elsewhere. What we are seeing in Europe is we didn't have the same push in terms of commercial space like you have in the US. And I think that has driven a lot of the boldness in introducing new manufacturing methods. Ileana, you work for Relativity. They tried to do something nobody has done before, to entirely build a launcher by additive. So I think commercial space has helped to go out of this traditional mindset that the more established players have. And because we didn't have that in Europe, we have a little bit of delay in introducing those new ways of thinking, new ways of manufacturing, new ways of designing parts, etc. We are catching up because we understand how you guys are succeeding. We saw the flight of Starship yesterday. And our leaders are slowly waking up to the fact that these new ways of doing things can be very helpful for innovation, and in the end, very helpful for profitability, cost, performance, etc. So you talked about ESA Space. We have Rocket Factory Augsburg, other new launcher manufacturers which are commercial and which the agencies are supporting. To work on their own feet, the same way NASA has supported SpaceX. So that is driving also a lot of innovation in terms of manufacturing. New players, new additive players. There's a swarm of small additive manufacturers, machine manufacturers who are in Europe, and there is a little bit of a Darwinian process for a few of them to emerge. But we are going to see that. And also, as Ileana said, other sectors, aviation, for example, is looking very seriously at additive, people like Airbus. And space is feeding into that, and space is learning from that. So I would say the revolution that we have seen in the US, driven by commercial space, is also starting to happen here.
Very interesting. Does anybody have any point of views on the Asia-Pacific region and their developments in the space industry?
I think Elion made a good point that I want to expand on a little bit more is, you know, for 2 decades as I've been in aerospace and really the rocket engine community, you know, we've had our annual conferences and we chat with each other, you know, about different developments, but the additive community is really unique. And I think that, you know, as a community coming together, I think it's going to happen. And we're seeing it happen, right? You go to these conferences, I know there's several of them now, but I feel like the conferences we go to, it's like a reunion. Like we're all friends, we're all buddies. You know, you see people and like, hey, you're hugging and stuff. And in that circle of people, you know, you're having a conversation and it's all the competitors and they're all talking to each other. And it's really unique that I think that as we toss challenges out to the industry or, you know, the space industry or aviation industry is like, hey, I need this. I feel there really is an opportunity for all these machine manufacturers or, you know, post-processing companies to have these conversations and start to standardize things more. Because I think that's one of the conversations that we talked earlier is how do we go about doing the standardization and come together as a community? And I see a lot of potential, you know, in that because it's just a unique community that I have not seen in other industries. You know, now that could have a downside too, that we might be feeding each other misinformation and saying how great additive is. And, you know, the traditional manufacturers are just laughing, saying, okay, let those additive guys do their thing. But I think there's, you know, that part of it is unique too, because building a culture around something is not easy. And the culture and getting through, you know, some of the hesitations of using additive and everything, like there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen besides just the technology, right? People are part of the technology. And I think the people that are involved in additive are some of the brightest out there. And I believe that as a community, you know, we can do this together.
Yeah, I'd agree, Paul. I come from the titanium world where in the spirit of cooperation for critical titanium parts on aircraft, there is something called the JET QC, Jet Engine Titanium Quality Committee, that came together to openly share information on any detectable defects on materials that go into critical application for rotating parts. Why? Because there were huge disasters of where, you know, flaws in things like fan discs and fan blades were resulted in people dying. And only as a result of that, that competitive nature was removed. So they come together of their own free will because they know that they needed to do that to work together to resolve those issues. But that only happened after a terrible disaster. So what I actually enjoy and what I am very gratified by seeing, Paul, as you mentioned, is that Additive Manufacturing Committee already voluntarily taking steps to, you know, combat some of that anti-competitiveness in things like we see in SAE Committee or ASTM F42 Committee. So the standards are being drawn. You know, there are things like MMPDS that exist for traditional materials. And where is the MMPDS for additive materials? Well, it's being written. And we don't have all the thousands of data points that we do in traditional world because, let's say, titanium, that's gone on for like 70 years. We've collected 70 years worth of thousands of data points for every single titanium grade that we ever made. That doesn't exist for AM. So we have to generate those things as we go along. And so all these organizations like Patel and so on are making those links, as you say, Paul, bringing that community together to do some of that sharing and say, you know, lessons learned and, you know, what is my best practice? So I found this was, you know, really helpful. And as we see, as people change jobs and move employers, they bring those best practices with them. They bring those learnings with them. And that's very helpful and actually really useful.
Yeah, all good points. It is always fun to go to these conferences. It's like you said, Paul, there's pros and cons. One, we're in this echo chamber and we just talk to each other. either everything is great or everything is super bad. It seems to be the middle ground sometimes is missing. But overall, it's definitely a community that I think works together well. I could probably talk more about the successes of applications. I think that's something we sometimes lack in the additive manufacturing industry is users talking about their accomplishments in additive and showing the rest of the world what's truly possible. But one last thing that before we wrap up here that I think is very near and dear to your heart, Paul, is really fostering education around additive manufacturing. How can we together make sure that engineers and technicians that are leaving schools and colleges and universities are equipped to enter this industry with additive manufacturing in mind?
Yeah, no, that's definitely a great topic on this. And you know, I think NASA is central to a lot of this in regards that we want to inspire the next generation. And I think being able to, you know, see rocket engine tests and Artemis SLS launch and some of the different missions, James Webb Space Telescope, right? We can all come together no matter where you are in the world and for a moment just forget about what's going on and just, you know, think about like what is out there, right? You see these fantastic images from James Webb and we all see the same thing and, you know, may have different views of like what is beyond Earth itself. So obviously that's, you know, a bit deep on that, but I think we can start with, you know, inspiring some of the high school students and even elementary school students, my kids, you know, who are elementary school age, like I talk to them about 3D printers in physics and they understand like how 3D printers work. And they've even gotten to print their own parts and it's fascinating to them, right? That they can create something from nothing on this. So I think trying to get more printers in schools and just showing some of the students just applications of it. Here's what you can do, right? You can make your own toys on this. Or when you get to the university level, I think that industry and government agencies need to stay really engaged with the research because there's a lot of things that we don't know about additive. And NASA tries to sponsor a lot of master's and PhD students on these topics that we need data for. We need this critical data. So we have the students go develop the data and then we use it in our everyday work. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there and just having those conversations, you know, with the community and more publicity around traditional manufacturing and additive manufacturing.
Yeah. You know, I think it's one of the key drivers of future growth that we really need to work on. Right? I mean, the manufacturing alone has, I say this a lot, 500,000 open jobs today in the US alone. I'm sure it doesn't look very different in the European Union. We're working on bringing capacity back to all of our countries, really. But yeah, we need some people to do the work. So if we can inspire people to get back into manufacturing, and I think space is a great driver to excite people to bring it back, I'm sure that we can accomplish that mission. I'm going to wrap it up here. This was a really, really awesome discussion. Thank you all for being on the show. I had a great time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
All right. And also a very big thank you to you out there, to our listeners. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Stay tuned for next week's episode where we have another set of fun guests. If you like this episode, if you learned something, please feel free to share, subscribe, whether if it's your favorite podcast platform or YouTube. And I'm Fabian Allerfeld, and I will see you next week.